revise the state's Department of Transportation and the creation of a new unit dedicated to decarbonization. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 87 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 86 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 21st, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Colombia to discuss the recent ruling in the U.S. court that held the notorious banana giant Chiquita Brands International responsible for funding a paramilitary group which led to the deaths of thousands of civilians. This month, a federal jury ordered Chiquita Brands International to pay over $38 million in damages to the families of eight Colombian men who were killed by paramilitaries the banana giant funded. Chiquita Brands, formerly known as the United Fruit Company, was found liable for the deaths of Colombian civilians due to its financing of the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, also known as the AUC, a brutal paramilitary death squad that was once deemed by the U.S. State Department as a terrorist organization. So today on the show, our guest today will not only tell us about the significance of this ruling in Colombia, but also how the tentacles of Chiquita Brands serves as a microcosm to how the free movement of capitalism undermines democracy. And so with us on the show today is Joshua Collins. He's a freelance reporter in Colombia focused on civil rights, migration, and the impact of crime upon human rights. His most recent article in NACLA, along with his co-author Daniela Díaz-Rangel, is entitled "Victims Win Historic Victory Against Chiquita in Colombia Paramilitary Case." He joins us today from Colombia. Welcome to the show, Joshua Collins.
Hello, Oscar. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So as I said before we started recording the show today, this case sort of opens a can of worms to a whole bunch of issues just on Colombia alone. But let's begin by quoting the press release by Earth Rights International, which is the NGO that represented the plaintiffs in this case, with the following, quote, "The jury's decision reaffirms what we have long asserted. Chiquita knowingly financed the AUC, a designated terrorist organization, in pursuit of profit. Despite the AUC's egregious human rights abuses, by providing over $1.7 million in illegal funding to the AUC from 1997 to 2004, Chiquita contributed to untold suffering and loss in the Colombian regions of Urabá and Magdalena, including the brutal murders of innocent civilians," end quote. So beginning there, can you give us more details from the ruling and tell us about the significance of the case in fighting human rights abuses in Colombia?
So it's the first time that a U.S. company has been found liable. Guilty is not the right word. It's a civil trial, but has been found liable for financing and conspiring with human rights abuses outside of the U.S. We've seen a number of lawsuits in Latin America, or at least investigations into other companies that have done similar things. But this is the first time that a large company has been found liable under U.S. law. So it's a pretty big precedent. As for how it affects Colombia, well, there's an ongoing case here, a criminal case against Chiquita, against eight of the executives from the period when they were paying the AUC. It's been very slow moving, but a lot of people are hoping that this gives momentum to the case. The president here, Gustavo Petro, made a statement the other day that was calling on Colombia's Peace Corps to investigate these findings and move the case along. Colombia also has a new prosecutor, Luz Adriana Camargo Garzón, who has also expressed interest in reopening, well, it was never closed, but in applying resources and attention to this case. So I think it's pretty safe to say that this is an impetus for the Colombian justice system to pressure investigators to put more resources and time into this case that's well over a decade long. So the background is that in 2007, Chiquita pleaded guilty to a State Department case in the United States of paying the AUC almost $2 million in 100 separate payments and disguising those payments as security, like legitimate security costs for the company. That is, they were fixing their books. They pled guilty to that as part of a plea bargain. They got $7 million fine. That's a sizable fine, but hardly something that would put Chiquita out of business. At the time, it was kind of viewed as a slap on the wrist. Eight employees from the company were fired. But this seems to be a much more impactful decision, both in the question of the amount of money changing hands, as well as precedents. And then there's also a number of other, both formal and informal investigations happening in Colombia towards other large North American companies. Coca-Cola has been implicated in trial by paramilitaries here in front of Colombia's Peace Corps. To briefly explain, Colombia signed a peace deal in 2016 with rebel group the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, better known as the FARC in English. That put an end to a 53-year civil war, technically, although there are still after effects of the war happening to this day. As part of that deal, they created an independent judicial branch called the Peace Court, the Jurisdicción Especial de la Paz. And that body has been investigating the civil rights abuses of both illegal armed groups and the government during the civil war. There are ongoing testimonies about paramilitary financing that have implicated Coca-Cola, a company that used to be called Gran Colombia Gold from Canada. They're now called Aris Mining. And it's also implicated Drummond Mining, the Alabama-based coal company. Of those companies, only Drummond has an active criminal case in Colombia. But I think that the general opinion here is that this puts a lot of public pressure on investigators who were appointed by very right-wing administrations in the past and tended to be very business-friendly. This is putting pressure on a left-wing administration to follow up with some of these investigations that might have been quashed or at least slowed down by previous prosecutors. So I believe that it's safe to say this is very impactful, at least on a symbolic level, for Colombian justice.
Yeah, and your article makes it very clear that this ruling is not the end of prosecution towards Chiquita, but probably the beginning with regards to other similar cases and accusations towards Chiquita, which again, formerly known as United Fruit Company, but we'll get to that portion of their history later. So I think you may have answered this already, but according to your NACLA article, could you explain how the 2016 peace agreement with the FARC played a role in the investigations led to this court ruling? And how does this Chiquita case tie perhaps to Colombia's false positive scandal from a few years ago? It may not seem like there's a direct tie at first, but I think we could explain that later on as we continue here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that you and a lot of you and your listeners are aware that the country, Colombia, is still reeling from the after effects of a more than half century civil war. The period for which Chiquita was found liable for paying paramilitary groups, AUC, was during the most violent part of Colombia's civil war, late 90s, early 2000s. So to answer your second question about how that ties into the false positives case, I have to kind of explain how the paramilitaries were created here in Colombia. So in the late 90s, a law passed. They created these groups called convivios, and that allowed private citizens and businesses to form defense groups because there were a lot of attacks by rebel forces on private infrastructure and private companies. Now, in theory, that law was supposed to prohibit money from going to illegal groups like the AUC, the AUC, whatever you want to call it. But in practice, there was very little regulation. And those convivios, as part of Colombian investigations, it turns out that they were massively funding these paramilitary groups. And it's part of the reason why the AUC, among hundreds of others, became so incredibly powerful during that period. During the Civil War, those groups were providing intelligence, logistics, support to Colombian military forces as part of fighting rebel groups. They were created to oppose the rebel groups, but they're nominally allied with the government as well. The problem, though, is that a lot of them quickly began to engage in extremely illegal behavior that included massacres, threats that removed people from their land so that large corporations could buy it. Agriculture was a big part of that. So was mining. There was a lot of industries that were tied into this. And so the false positives case was reinvestigated by the JEP, I believe, 3 years ago. I'll have to check the date. But the numbers were updated. What the case involved was that every year, every month, the military released statistics, fatalities of rebel groups they had killed. The idea was to portray this sense of like we're winning the war against the communists. But the false positive scandal was, it turns out that 6,400 people were killed by military forces that were completely innocent, and the military knew they were innocent. And they were killed by the forces to inflate those casualty reports, to give a sense that the Colombian military forces were winning the war against the rebels. It's a horrific case. The details are horrific. But we have multiple cases, and these are not just accusations. These are testimonies as part of Colombia's peace court, as well as Colombia's criminal courts, that paramilitaries were providing intelligence on who would be put into these false positive cases, as well as logistical supports, and sometimes even carrying out the murders themselves and delivering the bodies to the armed forces. They're probably not responsible for the vast majority of those deaths, but they did give very real material aid to that effort. And those killings were happening while Chiquita was paying the AUC. Here, the false positives case is emblematic of how bad the Civil War got and how both sides used terror and murder as a weapon to control civilian populations.
And to support your point, right about this time last year, the Washington Post reported that General Mario Montoya, the U.S.-trained general who headed Colombia's army, was charged with war crimes almost a year ago. And I bring this up with regards to the false positives case because one of the places that he led the military was in Antioquia, which is not that far, correct me if I'm wrong, from one of the two regions in the Chiquita case that was mentioned earlier at the top of the program.
So Urabá is actually a sub-region of Antioquia. So that's like the northern tip of Antioquia. And yeah, he was convicted. And what's interesting, another tie into the Chiquita case, is that he was convicted largely on testimony from a former AUC leader called Salvatore Mancuso. And Mancuso also testified in this Chiquita trial in the U.S. So we have ex-paramilitary leaders that are now trying to cooperate with Colombia's peace court in return for leniency for some of the crimes they committed. But that is very interesting. So Mancuso testified that not only was there not extortion, like there was no pressure from the AUC on Chiquita to make these payments. As I said, they weren't threats. They weren't like, give us money or we'll blow up your infrastructure. It was more that the AUC was approached by Chiquita because they were having problems with rebel groups in the region, and hired in what prosecutors described as an equal partnership. Chiquita's defense was that they were extorted and pressured and feared for their lives, and that's why they made these payments. But this testimony was rebutted in the Miami court case by Chiquita employees, residents in the region, and even two ex-paramilitary leaders who were working in the region at that time.
I was just about to ask you about that, if you could elaborate a little bit more on this, because as we often do on the show, we're going to create a link to your NACLA article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about this fascinating story, because included with the details that you just mentioned is actual evidence, like images of the evidence that was used in this court case. So with that said, going into some details of the case itself, can you explain Chiquita Brands' quote-unquote justification for funding the AUC and how former Chiquita employees as well as former members of the AUC discredited their claims during the course of this court proceeding?
Right. So that was an interesting defense strategy on the part of Chiquita. They denied they should be held liable for violence perpetuated by the AUC. They're arguing they were extorted by the AUC and those payments were made under duress because they feared for their own lives and their own employees, which sets up an interesting defense because the executives from Chiquita were arguing in court that they knew how brutal the AUC was. They knew that it was a terrorist organization. They knew that massacres were being carried out. There was no attempt to say, like, look, we had no idea. This was a matter of, like, ignorance. We were just trying to pay for security. No, quite the contrary. And that was part of their strategy to try and show to the court that they were scared, that these actions were taken under duress. But the defense argued that no one was making Chiquita stay in Colombia at the height of the Civil War. Nobody was making Chiquita acquire contracts for more banana production and more land at the height of the Civil War. But not just that, there were a number of internal communications that were very damning. One was an internal email from 2003, where an internal director wrote to the legal department from the office in the U.S. to the Colombian department, like, guys, we seem to be committing a felony here. And yet, Chiquita continued payments for almost another entire year. Not just that, there were internal documents that showed that they were using subcontractors and disguising these payments as security payments, in quotes, in tax filings to the U.S., which is fraud. That's a serious felony. There were also internal memos about meetings with Carlos Castaño Gil, who is, like, widely known as the godfather of paramilitarism in Colombia. To illustrate a bit who Carlos Castaño is to your listeners, he launched the earliest versions of the paramilitaries in Colombia. They were a direct response to the Medellin cartel in the 90s. They were basically created to kill rebels and to kill narcos that didn't pay him. He's an incredibly powerful figure in Colombia, or was, he's dead now. Politically, he was the political spokesman for the AUC. He was one of the founders of the AUC, and he was the prime advocate and was in charge of the organization when they moved heavily into narco trafficking, even though supposedly they were created to fight rebels and narco traffickers. So we have internal memos from Chiquita saying that they met directly with Carlos Castaño Gil. There's no legitimate reason why any U.S. businessman would have a formal meeting with the head of the AUC. Mancuso, who we mentioned earlier, testified that that meeting was at the request of Chiquita, and it was at the request to provide security for their operations in a number of northern departments, including Urabá and Magdalena.
The justification that I read in your article, it's to a certain degree quite frustrating because I've done countless shows here about people migrating and seeking refuge and seeking asylum because of extortion, real life extortion, not what was being portrayed here in this case. And to hear this type of justification, quote unquote, again, of extortion by the AUC against this multinational company, it's sort of like a backhanded way of crying poor. And it's just so condescending. And it goes back to what Earth Rights International said in their press release, that the motive here was not about extortion, but profit at the very beginning. It's such an odd justification. This is one of those portions of your article that I had to read twice with regards to the justification and how odd it was and how even odder it was that they think this was even going to work in the first place. I mean, if you're being extorted, oftentimes we've heard these stories of people leaving the country or being forced to leave the country because of extortion. It can't be said that a multinational company with millions of dollars can't do the same. And it just shows the profit motive underlying all of this, correct?
Oh, absolutely. There's a claim during one of the days in the courts when Charles Buck Kaiser, who was the director of Chiquita's operations from 87 to 2000, was questioned. And under questioning, he admitted that the Elk never tried to extort Chiquita. During that examination, Earth Defender lawyers asked them, why didn't they leave? Like, that seems like such a reasonable option. Why would you expose yourself not just to that liability, but I mean, that basically what they were arguing, there's a quote here, is that instead of trying to leave the country, Chiquita Brands instead chose to exacerbate and profit from it. That's an interesting statement from the plaintiffs. It goes back to a case in 2007, that criminal case in the State Department, in which Chiquita tried a very similar defense and also lost that criminal case. So to me, it seems a bit strange that they tried the same defense again in the civil case after it had already failed once. But yeah, the larger point is they made a conscious decision to stay there. And they made a conscious decision not just to try and survive the conflict, but to directly profit from it. That was a very conscious decision by executives at the time, to the point where the plaintiffs were arguing that they were using this instability to acquire more contracts and subcontracts with local producers. They were using the Elk to guarantee that through threats of towards campesinos, rural poor, we're using the Elk to threaten these people into signing contracts with Chiquita and no one else. That's an incredible claim.
Exactly. And again, it's infuriating to hear that in a court of law as a justification by a multinational company. I want to go back to something you just mentioned earlier, and that is the after effects of this sort of criminal wheeling and dealing that was mentioned in court. Now, the AUC is no longer what it was before, but there are splinter organizations or individuals afterwards that have continued to do all sorts of things, including killing innocent civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that isn't always taken into account, that just because this court ruling was made, just because the AUC is no more, it doesn't mean that the culture of violence and corruption ends right then and there. It continues on, and perhaps even worse and more uncontrolled as before. And these are the sort of things that these companies like Chiquita Brands don't take into account, correct?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that probably bears a bit of explaining.
Yes.
So officially in 2017, when the 2016 process was implemented, peace process here in Colombia, officially the 53-year war ended. But a lot of people describe the phase that Colombia is in now, not as post-conflict, implying that the conflict is over, but as post-accord. So there are a number of armed groups, most of them with some sort of at least ideological or historical ties to groups that existed during the Civil War. So the ideological inheritor of the AUC is a group here called, very similar name, the AGC. They're the Gaitanista Self-Defense Forces of Colombia. And they are the new iteration of what the AUC was. They're the largest criminal group in the country. They're the largest exporters of cocaine. They also control mass amounts of illegal mining, illegal lumber, and they run basically a nationwide, well, almost nationwide extortion racket. And their strongest point of power is Colombia's northern coast, and guess where? Urabá, where Chiquita Brands was conducting operations. They're the ideological successors of the Elk. But they exist alongside a number of dissident groups, rebel groups that did not sign the peace accord. They're often described here as sort of ex-FARC, but I think they still call themselves FARC. So it's kind of, we get into a terminology problem here. But contemporary rebel forces who are viewed as criminal armed groups by the government still exist, as well as other paramilitary groups. So Colombia is an interesting place because the cities, compared to the 90s, have had this sort of renaissance. Like Bogota has a lower murder rate than New York City, for example. Medellin used to be the murder capital of the world outside of war zones. And now it's well towards the bottom of the list, at least for Latin American countries. So in a sense, the peace process has been very successful. But in the areas that have always been conflict zones or areas that used to be controlled by the FARC, conflict very much is still happening. Areas like Chocó, areas like Urabá, where Chiquita was conducting operations, areas like Catatumbo, Putumayo, the Ecuadorian border. These are all routes that are still controlled more by criminal groups than they are by the governments. And I've done a lot of work on corporate malfeasance and responsibility in Colombia. And I mean, I have the main analyst, Elizabeth Dickinson, from an international crisis on record, saying, look, the cost of doing business in those communities is that you're paying someone. You go into that community and you want to do business there. You want to look for gold. You want to grow bananas or whatever. You know, before you go, that you will have to pay extortion to some of these groups. So what a lot of companies will do, though, is that they'll use subcontractors. Like Coca-Cola isn't directly paying whatever armed group is in charge of a region. Rather, they've got a contract with a Colombian company that is paid by Coca-Cola to manage it. And then that way, if they get caught paying the AGC or the ELN or the ex-FARC group, they're the ones who have the legal vulnerability, the liability problems, right? And this is not a wild accusation. Like, you can find multiple courts from the JEP that discuss this issue in detail, as well as testimony from both Colombian executive groups, from companies like Ecopetrol, or other banana groups that were operating in the same region as Chiquita at that time. But the Chiquita case is unique in that it's the first time a foreign company has been implicated directly and found liable in court. So a lot of people feel like this is really important for transitional justice in Colombia, like documenting what really happened and the real causes of the drivers of the civil war. And I hope they're right.
Now, see, the way you describe how multinational companies contract and subcontract these wheelings and dealings that lead to deaths of innocent people, we can easily apply that to Colombia, to Guatemala, to Honduras, to Brazil, on and on. So it's not exclusive to Chiquita Brands. It's not even exclusive to Colombia, this sort of nefarious actions by these sort of companies.
It's very true.
So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Joshua Collins, who's a freelance reporter in Colombia. His recent article in NACLA is entitled Victims Win Historic Victory Against Chiquita in Colombia Paramilitary Case. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Corazones, las luchas dispersas, busquemos las razones, juntemos nuestros brazos, la patria lo reclama, la lucha es de todo el que la quiere liberar, la lucha es de todo el que la quiere liberar. ¿Por qué no unirnos y por qué si ya se unieron el fusil y el evangelio en las manos de Camilo? ¿Por qué no unirnos y luchamos como hermanos por la patria que es herida, nuestra patria la que amamos? Pregunto, pregunto, ¿por qué nos dividimos si solo alegramos a nuestros enemigos? ¿Por qué nos empeñamos en aislar nuestras luchas, las luchas que nos deben llevar a la victoria final? Las luchas que nos deben llevar a la victoria final. ¿Por qué no unirnos y por qué si ya se unieron el fusil y el evangelio en las manos de Camilo? ¿Por qué no unirnos y gritamos como hermanos? ¡Viva Libia, viva el Chiema, agarrados de la mano! Paparirú, papapará, paparirú, papapará. Pregunto, pregunto, ¿por qué nos dividimos si solo alegramos a nuestros enemigos? ¿Por qué nos empeñamos en aislar nuestras luchas? Las luchas que nos deben llevar a la victoria final. Las luchas que nos deben llevar a la victoria final. ¿Por qué no unirnos y por qué si ya se unieron el fusil y el evangelio en las manos de Camilo? ¿Por qué no unirnos y gritamos como hermanos? ¡Viva Libia, viva el Chiema, agarrados de la mano! Pregunto, pregunto.
That was Los Guaraguao, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Colombia versus Chiquita Brands with freelance writer Joshua Collins, who's based in Colombia and whose recent article in NACLA is entitled Victims Win Historic Victory Against Chiquita in Colombia Paramilitary Case. So Joshua, while it wasn't mentioned too much in your article, it is unavoidable to not mention that Chiquita Brands was formerly known as the United Fruit Company. And the history of the United Fruit Company undermining democracy in Latin America goes as far back as the CIA coup in Guatemala in the 50s to as recently being a cheerleader to the Honduran coup in 2009. I have a clip here from Marco Simons, the general counsel of Earth Rights International, on Democracy Now! Last week, summarizing the United Fruit Company's public image in Colombia. Let's take a listen.
I'm sure we don't have time to go into the complete history of the United Fruit Company in Latin America, but suffice to say that they are probably the company that for the better part of the 20th century was most associated with American imperialism in Latin America. And in fact, one of Chiquita's own documents, when they were considering buying farms in Colombia back in the late 1980s, one of their own documents says that every Colombian school child was essentially taught that Chiquita was associated with Yankee imperialism and is the prime example of that in Colombia.
So that was Marco Simons, the general counsel for Earth Rights International, with a very interesting summarization of the United Fruit Company. So not only is there not enough time to discuss the whole history of United Fruit Company in Latin America on this show, there's barely enough time to discuss their history in Colombia alone. So to what degree would you measure this frame of reference to grassroots efforts to challenge companies like Chiquita Brands, especially in Colombia, now that we know how extensive their history is over there?
I think there's kind of two questions there. I'll try to briefly explain why the United Fruit Company is so important in Colombia especially, and then really briefly talk about their presence. So in the early 20th century, in 1928, there was a massive banana strike among plantation workers in Colombia. At the time, United Fruit Company deployed their private security forces and killed a number of people. That number is still disputed. Different historians put it at different numbers, at the very least hundreds, perhaps thousands, to smash this rebellion. And you talk to any Colombian anywhere and you mention the banana massacre, they're going to know who you're talking about. That is like part of Colombian history, a very important part of Colombian history. So to say that they're infamous in Colombia, I think is a bit of an understatement. But yeah, you're right. In the early 20th century, they had operations in Guatemala. They had operations in Honduras. They had operations in Cuba. They had operations in Colombia. The term banana republic comes from an author describing how they used to gain control over these local governments. And they would do it financially. They would do it by lobbying in Congress to the point where they would change laws and they would buy land that they didn't even need just to keep production down. Like, for example, in Honduras, they had almost as much land that was they were not using to produce crops as land that they were using to produce crops. And the idea was that they didn't want competitors in Honduras. And they had to advocate with the government to change laws to allow them to possess that much land that they weren't using. This is a very cynical approach to cornering the market, if you will, and kind of like an era of the robber barons and free market capitalism, as people like to say. But this had like very, very negative effects on poverty rates, on employment rates, on local economies. But as long as they were bribing these local officials or advocating to have politicians who agreed with their policies in office, there had like a very devastating effect on democracies across Latin America. And as you mentioned, they're tied to at least one coup directly. So it's like, there was a funny tweet. Somebody made like a fake Chiquita Brands thing last year. And they're like, no, despite like what you may have heard, we haven't toppled the government since 1954, pretending to be the Chiquita Brands official account, you know, obviously a fake tweet, but it was a funny example of the kind of reputation that they've earned. And yeah, of course, that later became Chiquita Brands. Basically, the United Fruit Company was acquired by a couple of other interests, but more importantly, that name had become so infamous that it was no longer useful for the company to use it, even within the United States, even with communities that didn't suffer the direct ramifications of these disruptive policies. As for how it ties into Colombian justice, well, there's no direct jurisprudence, no direct legal precedent that stems from the U.S. case. But as I kind of briefly mentioned at the top of the interview, I do think that it inspires a lot of investigators and prosecutors to look into ongoing cases against Chiquita specifically. They have a criminal case that's been going on since 2009 for aggravated conspiracy to commit a crime, and that includes falsification of records. But they also, I think what this case really does is it draws public attention to an issue that I think a lot of people never expected any remedy for. They never expected there to be justice in this case. I mean, you have to keep in mind, this investigation has been going on for almost 2 decades. For the piece that we wrote that you mentioned, we talked to the journalist here who was the first journalist to make these accusations.
Yes, I was just about to ask you about Ignacio Gomez and mm-hmm. his story and his almost 21-year struggle to bring more awareness to this case.
Yeah, so he was one of the first journalists in Colombia to publicize these accusations, and this is a very different time. It was 21 years ago. And at the time, he was facing threats from Chiquita lawyers in Colombia over lawsuits for defamation. He was receiving threats from paramilitary forces against both him and his family. And some of his work was used in that first 2007 case by the Justice Department. We spoke with him as part of this article, and I think for him, it was a very like personal vindication. I mean, a lot of people called him liars at first, right? I mean, including some rather powerful politicians in the Colombian government that didn't want these stories to come out. And to have this vindication, like he was telling the truth all along, that it just struck me as an incredibly brave move. I mean, we're talking about a period that was one of the most violent points in the Colombian civil war. It was not unusual for journalists to be assassinated by some of these armed groups and even occasionally by the government. So he just struck me as an incredibly brave man. But for him, he views this as a longstanding debt that the United Fruit Company has, not just in Colombia, but for all of Latin America where they operated. His exact quote was, "This debt is finally starting to be paid. In a country still suffering the after effects of 53 years of civil war, fueled at least in part by the actions of private companies like Chiquita, we have hundreds of thousands of reasons to celebrate this ruling." He's, of course, talking about the number of people killed during Colombia's half-century conflict.
I think the best way for an American audience to understand the significance of his work is perhaps compare him to the late journalist Gary Webb, who back in the 1990s did work for the San Jose Mercury News, exposing, I guess, what was called the Dark Alliance, which showed drug trafficking by the CIA during the Contra War in the 80s, and how that affected communities in California, just in California, to say the least. So just to make that comparison, because I think his work is crucial not only for this case, but also in raising awareness to companies like these. And we have to make it very clear, if not already, that this type of criminal financial transaction between multinational companies and various nefarious groups is not exclusive to Chiquita Brands. Even today, I mean, you said the word robber barons, and it sounds like an antiquated word, but their existence is in the present tense. They are still in existence in various parts of Latin America even today. So, for example, you already cited in your NACLA article that the same legal arguments can be made against Coca-Cola, the U.S. coal company Drummond, the Canadian mining company Aris Mining, which I think we could point a lot more to Honduras just as much as Colombia, mm-hmm. among others. I remember last year here on the show, I did a show on the plight of the Mapuches in Chile.
Ah, cool.
And there were similar accusations of the apparel company, the United Colors of Benetton, that sound very similar to what we're discussing here. So my question here is, what precedent does this case have in similar cases outside of Colombia, especially when this ruling was in a U.S. court?
Yeah, well, I think that is a fantastic question. So we seem to have a precedent that a U.S. company can be civilly liable for damages that they committed in another country, right? So on its face, this is a big case against Chiquita. But I think it also encourages plaintiffs to try and hold other corporations responsible. But perhaps more importantly, perhaps most importantly, is that corporations are interesting entities. Like, they're not one person, right? They're a series of different people that are changing over time. And really, the most effective way to change a corporation's behavior is to affect the amount of money they produce. So if corporations globally, even huge ones, feel they might be exposed legally because of actions they used to be able to get away with impunity, I think that sets a very important standard. Even if there's not a direct legal argument to tie the two courses together, I think that it certainly affects the decisions that these companies are making. And as you mentioned, like, this is something that very much happens, is ongoing, is happening today. Like I mentioned that quote from the International Crisis Group earlier, like they were saying, of course, this happens in Honduras, this happens in Guatemala, this happens in Mexico, this happens in Colombia. Like, these are decisions that these companies know they're going to be faced with when they enter areas that are controlled by non-state actors.
Precisely. I want to go back to the case of Ignacio Gomez just to highlight how important his work is in exposing this story in Colombia, because there is this rather obscure story, and this sort of lends itself to the power of companies like Chiquita Brands when it comes to having control of the narrative of what we're discussing here. Because back in 1998, I think it was a newspaper in Cincinnati that was forced to make an apology to Chiquita Brands for doing an expose to things that are pretty much similar to what we're discussing here. Because as we just mentioned in the case, that this goes as far back as 1997, these wheelings and dealings, and a major newspaper in Cincinnati was forced to apologize in 98, almost a year after this whole shenanigan started, for exposing the very thing that we're discussing here today, but also that what a U.S. court has ruled already.
It's very interesting. We actually asked him about that. So my colleague Daniela was the one that reached out to him, Daniela Diaz, who co-wrote the piece. And his first response to us contacting him was, who is this article for? Who are you guys writing for? And she mentioned that the piece was for NACLA. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll totally talk to you guys. Because it wasn't just the Cincinnati newspaper that was forced to pull down the article. There were a lot of Colombian media companies that did pull down these accusations that were by him because they were scared of legal threats from Chiquita. But NACLA was one of the few groups that kept the article up despite the legal threats in the U.S. So I think that it was a small little piece of ironic justice for him, I think, to be quoted again in by the same organization, you know, 20 years later. But yeah, I mean, maybe the quickest way to explain this is that Reporters Sin Fronteras talks about, they put like numbers and ranks on press freedom across the country. And a lot of Latin American countries, at least for countries that are not officially dictatorships or in active war zones, tend to score rather low in those ratings of press freedoms. And in a lot of those countries, it's because the tort and legal laws have been twisted against journalists. So what happens is that a company can threaten defamation for a story that may be true, and the journalist is in this position where, okay, well, I could face jail time if I lose this legal case. And not just that, but I'll have to pay for a lawyer, I'll have to defend myself in courts. This is all money that I will be spending, even if I happen to win. And I'm going up against a team of very powerful legal experts. So a lot of times in Colombia or Honduras, it's easier for the journalist to simply retract the story than to risk their personal freedom and spend those resources defending themselves. So I think that kind of is an addition, in Colombia at least, to active threats these journalists were receiving. So, I mean, I bring that all up just to kind of point out that I have an incredible amount of respect for Ignacio Gomez. He was working at a time where journalism was a lot more dangerous. And as a Colombian national, it's more dangerous for him than it is for me as a foreigner. I'm sort of protected by the embassy a little bit. All of that is to simply point out the amount of bravery that Gomez must have had in those early days to publish those stories, knowing that this would be the effect.
And I think it also shows a wider degree of censorship during the 1990s, because the tobacco industry and the meat industry sort of did something very similar, not to this newspaper in Cincinnati, but to other media outlets even bigger in the 1990s, which goes to show you how powerful these companies were when it came to censorship back in the 1990s.
Absolutely.
So we have about 8 minutes left. And like I said before, we're going to create a link to this article so people can learn more and so people can see the evidence that you also displayed in the article as well. And again, we got to give a shout out to Daniela Diaz Rangel, who also co-wrote this. And both of you guys did fantastic work here. So again, as I said in the beginning, this is a Pandora's box that hopefully will inspire more people to go after these companies in much the same manner and to bring this information out to light or to bring more awareness, generally speaking. But in the minutes that we have left, what else do you hope people take from this article? What else do you hope people learn from this case as it continues to develop? Because, again, this is not in the past tense. There may be more types of cases towards Chiquita Brands and not just them alone as well.
Yeah, I think that there's a very interesting perception among a lot of people, not all, but a lot of people in North American countries, wealthy countries like Canada, the United States, where they say, okay, well, Drummond employs 30,000 people in Colombia. They're creating economic developments, they're investing in these communities, and they're raising the GDP. So foreign investment, right? I'm not trying to say that foreign investment is bad, but I think there's a perception among a lot of people in the United States and Canada and perhaps parts of Europe that it's always good. And it's not always good. And it's true that you can look at some of these companies where Drummond has perhaps built roads or perhaps they donated some money to a school and they do create jobs. And there is some economic movement because of these activities. But the story isn't as simple as that. A lot of these companies, even if they're not directly committing human rights violations, it's sort of like paying taxes, right? Like if you go set up a gold mining company in Chocó, Colombia, which is like one of the more conflict-ridden regions, it isn't a matter of if. It's a matter of when someone shows up and says, oh, that's a nice gold mine you got there. We're going to blow it up if you don't give us money. And you know in that situation as a business owner that you're going to be paying a group that is up to some horrific stuff. And so like the decision that these companies make to go operate in those zones anyway and find legal workarounds to avoid directly breaking criminal law, at least, I think you can argue that that's an ethical decision. And that's a problem. Even if this fictional gold company we're talking about is employing 5,000 people and they built a road, okay, but they're also financing the criminal group that is displacing thousands of people in the region, that is killing people who are trying to form unions and doing so knowingly, even if not directly. And I think it's safe to say that in any country in Latin America where there are regions that are controlled by non-state actors, all of those companies are dealing with this dynamic. I don't think it's an overstatement by any means. And like I said, I don't think that this case means that this will be criminal prosecution of all of those companies. But I do think that the legal exposure to civil fines and liabilities might perhaps make them rethink some of these decisions. At least that's the hope that a lot of activists here in Colombia that advocate for a peace process and restorative justice have been talking about in the last 2 weeks.
Precisely. And actually, you know what? One final question here, because I think when we do stories like these, we also have to raise awareness to the fact that consumers have to be aware of these sort of things as well when it comes to where their commodities are coming from. You know, so for example, if anyone buys coffee, a bag of coffee, you'll see that it's fair trade use or will have that label. And many other commodities that we buy in the grocery stores have similar labels. And so it's not just these companies that need to be held responsible, but consumers at the very least should be more aware of these sort of things and have perhaps a greater understanding of where their products are coming from and under what circumstances. Is that a fair thing to say that consumers should have or should play a role in this discussion here? And especially when it comes to the commodities that may lead to people's lives.
No, I agree. I think we've seen examples in recent U.S. history of consumer-led boycotts that have affected the decisions of companies. I think that there's a very real power there that consumers can possess. I think also, though, sometimes it's a little difficult. I don't expect my mother, for example, to wake up and spend 2 hours researching what she can buy at the supermarket that's ethically sourced, right? I mean, there's a level of commitment that perhaps is...
A balance, a difficult balance.
Right. But there are some industries, though, where that's nearly impossible. A great example here is mining in Colombia. Something like 80% of the gold that is exported from Colombia is likely illegally mined by armed groups. But the problem is that tracing the origins of gold is incredibly expensive. You need to run it through, I don't forget the name of the machine, I'm going to say it wrong, but electrospectrometer. Sorry, I don't know. You'll have to Google the actual name. But the point is that like identifying through these analyses, these machines, where this gold came from is incredibly expensive. And gold is very fungible. You can melt it down, put it in something else, and sell that. So chances are, if you're buying gold that has been produced in or near Colombia, it was probably produced by armed groups, and they're probably profiting from that. So that's just like a micro example of that sometimes consumers can wield a considerable amount of power. I strongly agree with what you say. But at other times, it's kind of difficult. The information is intentionally opaque, and consumers really have no way of knowing, at least when it comes to some products, which ones are being produced ethically or even legally.
And this is precisely why I want to have you on the show. And this is precisely why I love highlighting stories like these that you co-wrote with Daniela Diaz-Rangel as well. Because at the very least, what we could do with our platforms is to raise awareness, not just for consumers' sake, not just for legal sake, but because lives are at stake as well
Absolutely.
In the process. So with that said, we've been speaking with Joshua Collins. He's a freelance reporter in Colombia focused on civil rights, migration, and the impact of crime upon human rights. His recent article in NACLA is entitled Victims Win Historic Victory Against Chiquita in Colombia Paramilitary Case. And as I mentioned already, we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, Joshua Collins, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thanks, Oscar. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The Supreme Court has upheld a federal gun control law that's intended to protect domestic violence victims. The justices ruled 8-1 today in favor of a 1994 ban on firearms for people under restraining orders to stay away from their spouses or partners. The justices reversed a ruling from a federal appeals court in New Orleans that had struck down the law. The case involved a Texas man accused of hitting his girlfriend and threatening to shoot her. It's the justices' first Second Amendment case since they expanded gun rights in 2022. Gun control advocates are hailing the move. Every Town for Gun Safety said on social media, the fact the court sided against gun rights extremists today is a huge win for gun safety and survivors all across the country. But we should not have been here in the first place, Every Town said. A heat dome is moving closer to the breaking point from the U.S. Midwest to New England. There's no immediate relief in sight, though, for much of the country. The National Weather Service says the heat and humidity could send heat index readings above 100 degrees in many locations, possibly breaking all-time records. The Weather Service also predicts another scorching weekend with triple-digit highs in California and Arizona. India's health ministry says there's been at least 110 heat stroke deaths this year due to heat waves. The World Health Organization is warning summer heat is worsening, and that could lead to a massive public health crisis in Gaza due to the lack of clean water, food, and medical supplies. Dr. Richard Piepercorn is the WHO's representative for Gaza and the West Bank.
We have water contamination because of hot water, and we will have much more food spoilage because of the high temperature. We will get insect, mosquitoes, and flies, but also dehydration, heat stroke, etc. In combination already with the incredibly poor water and sanitation circumstances, we have seen already more than 20-25 times as much diarrhea as normal. We see a huge number of people with hepatitis A.
He also said 17 of 36 hospitals are barely functioning and called for Israel to open the Rafah border crossing so they could transfer thousands of patients who need care Gaza hospitals can no longer provide. Armenia today said it will recognize a Palestinian state, making it the latest European nation to do so following Ireland, Norway, and Spain's recognition last month. The charges against dozens of anti-war activists who occupied a Columbia University building in April were dropped Thursday. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg dropped the charges against 30 students and staff members at Columbia who were arrested, citing insufficient evidence against them. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders is calling on legislation that would increase teacher pay in the U.S. Christopher Martinez reports.
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont sees low pay as being at the heart of challenges facing public schools.
There is, in fact, nothing more important that we can do than provide a quality education to all of our young people. And yet, for decades, public school teachers have been overworked, underpaid, understaffed, and maybe most importantly, underappreciated.
Sanders reviewed some grim statistics about things like teacher turnover. 44% of teachers leave their job in their first 5 years. And nearly 10% of teaching positions are left vacant or filled by teachers not fully certified. Sanders presented his proposal, the Pay Teachers Act. It would pay teachers what he calls decent wages and benefits. And he adds, it's not a very radical or controversial concept.
This bill would make sure that no teacher in America is paid less than $60,000 a year.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
WPFW, Washington.